Good morning and welcome to counsel for the second case. The second case on today's oral argument calendar is number A23-0131, David Matthew Johnson versus State of Minnesota. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Dan Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S, and I'm here for the appellant, David Johnson. Mr. Johnson is not with us today, but I've talked to him about the case, and he's comfortable proceeding in his absence. I'll start with just a short factual background for the case, and then proceed with the argument. The facts are pretty straightforward and pretty clear. In June of 2018, Mr. Johnson pled guilty to criminal theft. It was a white-collar crime. He worked for Alliant at the time, and the damages for the theft were a little over $500,000. He had an insurance policy with Alina, and the restitution order of the court indicated that it would reduce the restitution amount of $296,000 to $250,000 if the claim was paid by Alina. Great American then was subrogated to the claims.
So, Mr. Rasmus, I'm going to interrupt you, sure, if you don't mind, because I think we are familiar with the facts, but I'd like to jump into the argument. So, and let me ask the first question, and that is your briefing focuses a lot on the complaint in the civil action.
Right.
District court's decision focused mostly on the settlement agreement.
Right.
Doesn't the settlement agreement give a different? In the open courtroom, where I think we're hampered a little bit by the fact that, as I understand it, the settlement agreement was confidential and still is confidential.
It is confidential, is correct.
And it's been filed under seal, has it?
That it has, and I think we filed a redacted version, and filed the parts that were not confidential.
Right. So I mean, I might prefer to be more specific in my questions, but let me just ask more generally: isn't it true that a review of the settlement agreement gives a different picture of the civil action than a review of the complaint?
Well, I think that the result does, Your Honor. I'd agree with that. I think the issue is whether, what does subrogation mean really in the end? If it's stepping into the shoes of the other party, and if Great American truly stepped into Alina's shoes, then in the settlement agreement, Alina, I mean, for the public record here, I mean, I think we can say that Great American didn't cover the full amount, which typically never happens in a settlement agreement. But even though the full amount wasn't recovered, I think that to the extent that Great American gave up its right to claim the full amount because of the fact that Great American stepped into Alina's shoes, then our contention would be that the rights that Great American gave up are tantamount to the rights that Alina gave up. Because if you're stepping into the shoes of this other party, I mean, you're really a party as if you were there yourself. And then
Counsel,
what, excuse me, yes, Your Honor.
The issue before the district court was the restitution order itself,
right,
correct?
Right,
and
right.
Whether, and I think you were trying to argue that the terms of the restitution order had been fulfilled and therefore it should be vacated. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the restitution order required payment to Alina Health.
Correct.
And I don't see any evidence in the record that there was a payment to Alina Health of its deductible amount.
I can't contest that, Your Honor. I think that's true. That's a fact. But again,
so how did the district court abuse its discretion in concluding that the terms of the restitution order were not met and there wasn't?
I would contend that it was an abuse of discretion, but that it was clearly an erroneous factual finding and then an error of law on applying subrogation. So on the first element of the factual determination, at page 3 of its order, the court indicates that it believed that Great American Debt did not attempt to recover the deductible, which I think is not true, because in the complaint, it's clear that it's not.
But in the end, its analysis was based on the fact that the restitution hadn't, that Allina hadn't received the amount of restitution that it was ordered to receive.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, even if that factual finding was not stated as articulately as it could have been, I don't think that was the basis for the district court's conclusion.
Well, and I think what the district court said at page 4 is that Allina did not agree to waive or release restitution. So it's not so much the fact that restitution wasn't paid, it's that Allina did not waive its right to restitution. And I think that that's what's inaccurate. Because if Great American has stepped into the shoes of Allina and Great American waived the right to claim the full amount, then if it fully stepped into the shoes, it's not conditional, it's not, it's not partial, it's fully and complete stepping into the shoes, then to the extent that Great American waived its right to the full amount, then Allina did too. I mean, that's really the nuts and bolts and the summary of our argument. And I was trying to think of a hypothetical, so let me see if this will work. I don't know if the court is interested or not, or if it helps. But I was trying to think of it this way. So let's assume that the case went to judgment. It went to trial, and Great American won the entire $750,000. So they got the full amount back for the damages, and then also the restitution amount, because that was clearly part of their complaint. If then Allina was back in front of this court asking that it gets the $250,000 restitution amount, I mean, I think the answer to that question is no. I think at that point, what the court would have to conclude is that Allina contracted away its right through subrogation to get the restitution amount, and to the extent that, again, Great American stepped into the shoes of Allina, Allina doesn't have any rights anymore to that money as a part of the civil action. And then again, if it's waived and released through the settlement, our argument would be that Allina has waived it as well. I mean,
the state argues that the district court lack jurisdiction to even address the motion or modify the restitution order because your motion, appellant's motion, was filed after appellant's sentence expired. And would you agree that appellant's sentence expired on March 5th, 2022?
Mr. Johnson was committed to the commissioner his prison sentence, and then he did finish the sentence. He was on parole, so the court technically did expire. But our argument would be that the district court still has jurisdiction over enforcing the order. I mean,
you didn't ask the court to. The motion wasn't relating to enforcement of the order. The motion was to vacate the order.
I understand, but if the court has jurisdiction.
So it'd be a different matter if the state brought a collection suit against your client, and then your client argued in that suit that, you know, the debt had already been satisfied. But that's not what happened here.
No. I would argue, Your Honor, that if the district court has authority to enforce, then it would have authority to release as well. I mean, it either has jurisdiction or it doesn't. And
what would you rely on? What would you point us to support?
Let me see what I...
Your argument that the district court had jurisdiction to vacate the order after the sentence expired.
No, I addressed that in my reply brief. The cases I cite there indicate that payment of restitution is part of the criminal sentence. I'd rely on the briefing there, Your Honor. I don't have anything other than what's in our brief.
I have a question about your argument about the amount sought in the complaint in the civil action. I'm looking at the statute authorizing restitution, and it says the request for restitution may include but is not limited to any out-of-pocket losses resulting from the crime, .. I mean, I think isn't that kind of the touchstone of the district court's analysis in order to trying to figure out, I mean, at the time of sentencing, mm-hmm. the district judge was aware of the financial consequences on Alina. And I think, if I'm correct, the original sentencing order said that the amount would be reduced if Alina's insurer compensated it for its loss, but not for a deductible of $250.
I think that's correct.
And so that contemplates that if Alina still has out-of-pocket losses equal to its deductible, then it's going to still be entitled to restitution. So after the settlement agreement, if we look at that confidential settlement agreement, I mean, don't we still see that Alina has out-of-pocket losses equal to $250?
I'd have to agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, I don't think there's any question. I think there's a real tension here. I mean, so Great American gave up its right to get full compensation for the $500,000 damages as well as the $250,000 it was trying to recover in restitution through its complaint as well. It would be a harsh result for Alina not to be able to recover if the court would grant our motion. But I mean, these are sophisticated entities, and subrogation is a well-known legal principle. And if it applies, it applies. And if there was truly a stepping into the shoes of Alina on the part of Great American, and then again, Great American, you know, gave up the right to continue, even though it's true that Alina didn't get what it was ordered to get in the restitution order, and it had out-of-pocket losses, it's got to live with the decision that it got into, or into the agreement it got into with Alina through subrogation, that that right was given up. There are lots of examples, and we cite it in our.
If we look at the settlement agreement, having difficulty forming a question without disclosing a confidential document, but it doesn't seem like there was any kind of a forfeiture or waiver of a right to for Alina's right to recover its out-of-pocket losses.
And I'd have to agree with that as well, Your Honor. I mean, I think it's true that Alina was not independently on its own a party. But the question is, through subrogation, whether it was a party as having stepped into the shoes, having its shoes stepped into by Great American. So, I mean, again, all I can rely upon is the subrogation principle that when Great American waived its right to get the whole amount, including the restitution amount, it did so on behalf of Alina as well.
Am I correct that let's take a hypothetical case where insured has losses of $750, insurer pays, the benefits under the insurance policy of $500 with a $250 deductible, and then the insured goes after the tortfeasor, collects $750. I think in that situation, the insurer would then pay the insured for its full losses. Am I correct about that, or does the insured keep the seven? Does the insured keep the excess? Basically, keep the $250. It's compensated for its own $500
Sure.
and losses, but what happens to the excess?
I mean, I would have to, you know, I would think it'd be up to the discretion of the insurer at that point to decide what it wanted to do. It would depend on the, I suppose, the nature of the subrogation agreement too.
I suspect Judge Hallbricks knows the answer, and I'll ask her later.
Okay, very good. If there's no other questions, I think I'll sit down at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmus.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney here on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. This case regards appellant's theft by swindle of $750,000 from his previous employer, Alina. And I believe counsel stated that the theft totaled about a little over $500,000, but according to the full years of theft, between 2004 and 2017, it is $750,000 worth of funds that appellant stole from his employer, Alina. But due to the statute of limitations, appellant was only charged with theft by swindle of approximately $300,000 between the period allowed by the statute of limitations, which was 2013 and 2017. And appellant in this case obtained a very favorable plea agreement, received a guideline sentence, and agreed to pay restitution to Alina for its out-of-pocket costs. In this case, it's $250,000 for its insurance deductible, which to this day, Alina has still not recovered. That amount is an out-of-pocket loss, and under the restitution statutes, under the definition of a victim, under case law's definition of what is an out-of-pocket loss, the deductible counts. Appellant is required to pay that amount. The district court did not abuse its discretion in denying that motion, but as respondent's brief lays out, the district court should have denied the motion due to lack of jurisdiction, but even if it had jurisdiction to address the motion, it did not abuse its discretion in upholding the $250,000 amount, which it had contemplated in both its original restitution order and its modified restitution order as well.
Let's talk about jurisdiction for a minute. In part A of your brief on page 7, you cite some cases about expiration of sentence, Hannum, Purdy, Martinek. Am I correct that none of those cases concern restitution orders? They're all about confinement, whether it's sentence or whether it's imprisonment or incarceration or release?
Or conditional release. That's correct, Your Honor. And the interesting thing about that case law, though, is that appellants generally, or defendants generally benefit from the lack of jurisdiction in a sentence. And in this case, it works against appellant. Because the district court lacked jurisdiction to amend its restitution order, and restitution is part of the sentence, because the sentence had already expired, then it does not benefit appellant to pursue that route.
So, but here's my point, I guess, is that if a defendant has only a prison sentence, mm-hmm. and let's say prison plus supervised release, and at the end of supervised release, then the sentence has expired, and I think we sometimes say the sentence is discharged. Is that correct? So, because that's all there is. It was confinement and supervised release. Everything that the district court included in the sentencing order is done. But if a defendant has, let's say, both prison and a restitution order, in one,
yes.
and in here, the restitution obligation exists until 2026, right? So if the defendant has finished his prison sentence mm-hmm. but hasn't paid off the restitution, has he discharged his sentence?
I think I understand your question, Your Honor. And what happens at sentence discharge is that the sentence expiration date is the end of the period of incarceration and conditional release period or supervised period. And that's also the due date for the restitution amount. If the restitution amount is not made by that date, it then gets converted to a civil judgment. So it moves from a criminal restitution case into a civil judgment case. And unfortunately, I'm a criminal law attorney, so when we're talking about what happens when it translates to a civil judgment, and actually in this case, when the Minnesota Department of Revenue is then attempting to collect from appellant, that's a whole nother animal. That's a different process than what happens in a criminal restitution case and a criminal case in general. So I hope that answers.
Just to clarify, under the restitution order, in this case, as I read it, Mr. Johnson was required to pay the restitution at the time of his release because he wasn't put on probation. Is that correct? Or it, when was he, looking at the restitution order, when was he required to pay the restitution? Maybe at least 6 months before his release.
Well,
when was he required to pay the full amount of the restitution?
The ultimate deadline for restitution is the day the sentence expires.
Okay, and what is your basis for that statement?
Oh, because the restitution statutes have a vehicle by which, at the expiration, it transfers to the restitution award, the amount owed by the defendant, transfers to a civil judgment. And I don't know the exact vehicle that operates, but it's not something that I am in charge of doing. It's not something that a victim or the CVRB must trigger. That is something that happens, I believe, by operation of law.
Well, and if you look at the addendum at page 2, it has restitution findings and order, and it talks about the payment schedule. And then it talks about if payment is not made according to the schedule, then the entire amount shall become due immediately, and that matter may be forwarded to the Department of Revenue for collections pursuant to 609.104. So, but paragraph 5 is the time for payment, and given here that the amount is over $2,500, it says defendant must pay in full at least 6 months before the end of probation. We don't have probation here, as I understand it. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
You are not wrong about that. There was
so is 6 months before the end of probation, 6 months before the end of his release from prison then?
Your Honor, what I will agree to is that restitution orders can be unsatisfying or incomplete because the restitution forms don't fit in every restitution case. But what the form is based on is the restitution statutes in this case. So 611A04 indicates that a district court has to include either a payment structure or appoint someone else to handle the payment structure. And in this case, the form happens to say 6 months before probation. But again, in this case, there is no probation ordered in this case. It was a period of incarceration, a supervised release period with an expiration date.
But both of those expired as of March 2022.
Correct. And so because that expired, because the expiration date expired, this restitution amount is no longer under the jurisdiction of the criminal court that issued the restitution order. And the reason that is so is because this matter, this restitution amount, then changes into a civil judgment amount, which is pursued by other means and can be contested by defendants in other ways. In the statute, if the defendant does not want this restitution amount to be transferred to a civil judgment and pursued by the Minnesota Department of Revenue, they can challenge that. And in this case, appellant did not. Had that occurred here?
The civil judgment process and that.
Is that what the Department of Revenue collection notice is?
Yes. The civil judgment has been pursued, and the Minnesota Department of Revenue is seeking that. That is what triggered appellant to file its motion in the closed criminal case, if that makes sense. But had appellant contested the referral to collections in a civil judgment, that could have been a fight. Appellant could have been pursuing some fight within the civil judgment realm, but that did not occur. And it didn't occur in the criminal case until the restitution, until the sentence expired.
So if appellant had filed his motion in, well, the settlement agreement, I think the public record shows it was entered in June 2020. If appellant had filed his motion in August 2020, at that point, would you say the court had jurisdiction to address the motion?
Yes, because the sentence had not expired till 2022.
What about?
But
I'm sorry. What about the rules of criminal procedure that say that the court may at any time correct a sentence not authorized by law.
That is what that rule says, but that rule is not limitless. And in one of the cases that I cited, it is Martinek, M-A-R-T-I-N-E-K, this court's opinion from 2004. Once a sentence has expired, the court no longer has jurisdiction to modify even what may be an unauthorized sentence. And I believe in State versus Hannam, H-A-N-N-A-M, in that case, this court determined that the Court of Appeals and the District Court, neither court has jurisdiction to discuss how to amend in a sentence, how to amend a sentence after the sentence has expired. So in both those cases, it means that the District Court and this court don't have jurisdiction to amend a sentencing order post its expiration. So that Rule 27 is not limitless in this regard, even if it's an unauthorized sentence. But if the motion, if appellant had brought a motion to vacate the restitution order prior to the sentence expiring, then we move on to Section B of respondent's brief, where then it's really up to the district court's discretion whether or not to order it. And in this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion in ordering it, and it did not abuse its discretion in order in refusing to vacate the restitution order for all the reasons outlined in respondent's brief. If I may have just a moment. Your Honors, I do think the case law is clear. In the case of In Re Welfare MRH and the Arends case, that the crux of restitution here is to not allow victims to double dip. There is no indication in this case that Alina is attempting to double dip its hefty deductible amount of $250,000. And I will respect the confidentiality of the settlement agreement, but what I think is common sense is that if an insurer and a sort of tortfeasor, I guess is the word, reach a settlement agreement, it is undoubtedly for less than the amount sought by the complaint. And so it's common sense that the full amount sought by Alina's insurer was not received by Alina. And in this case, it would be wholly unjust for an individual who has stolen $750,000 from his employer to pay zero in restitution when its victim has a statutory right to restitution and has demonstrated the out-of-pocket loss of $250,000, the propriety of which appellant has never disputed. Appellant is just attempting to dispute that it was fulfilled by a separate civil contract for insurance. I won't belabor the point, but I will emphasize that if we take out the fact that this was like a, quote, white-collar crime, and imagine this is just a typical car accident case, I think this court should be very concerned with making a new rule that any time an injured person seeks compensation through a lawful insurance contract, that that would somehow preclude them or extinguish their statutory right to restitution for out-of-pocket losses that remain. That is a very concerning rule that this court should not adopt. So if the...
Can I take you back to the jurisdictional argument
yes.
for a minute? Did you raise this issue before the district court?
No. And I believe it was in a footnote in respondent's brief. Jurisdictional arguments are not waivable, and as a respondent, respondents can advance arguments not raised below if the arguments are raised in support of affirmance. And that is because this court can affirm on any grounds to avoid an absurd result. And so to find that the district court abused its discretion here and thus making a new rule that anyone injured availing themselves of insurance cannot seek restitution for further out-of-pocket costs, that would be an absurd result. And thinking back to this matter as just being...
I'd like to follow up on Judge Cochran's question. Is this a matter of subject matter jurisdiction or some other type of jurisdiction?
It is subject matter jurisdiction,
is
which is not waivable. In this criminal case, the district court was attempting to exercise authority over this criminal case, this restitution order, when it did not have the ability to do so. And because that is, because that argument was not raised below, it can still be raised now because it does fall under subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, I guess my question is whether it does fall under subject matter jurisdiction as opposed to something that's not subject matter, or perhaps like it's a
personal of some kind.
Perhaps it's not jurisdictional, but I mean, the word jurisdiction, I mean, you're not relying on a statute that uses the word jurisdiction. You're relying, I'm not sure what you're relying on, but.
Your Honor, I'm relying on the four cases, or excuse me, the three cases. State versus Willis.
But at bottom, I mean, usually a court's jurisdiction is, I think, usually determined by the Constitution and by statute, you know, a court's subject matter jurisdiction. So, you know, which statute, I'm not sure which statutes were being interpreted in the case law that you cited, but.
Oh, I think I understand Your Honor's question, or Your Honor's question to me, but I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of a particular statutory site, but I mean, at bottom, Your Honor, when a defendant's sentence expires, they are free of that criminal district court's authority to order them to do anything. If they want to continue to fight about their criminal case, they need to bring those fights before the expiration of their sentence. After the expiration of their sentence, they can fight civilly about restitution in a civil judgment sense and fight with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. But for that criminal case, for the criminal restitution, to fight about that, it needs to be within the window of time when a district court has jurisdiction over that subject. So if Your Honor wants me to include a sort of letter of supplemental authority to try to find that statute, I can do that, but brass tacks, that was my argument.
I was going to ask, I mean, you were telling us about how a restitution judgment that's unpaid mm-hmm. at the time of expiration sort of kind of mutates into a civil judgment. And is that, you know, I'm curious about the statutes that govern that. And are they in 611A or are they in 609 or somewhere else?
I believe I'm out of time. May I respond,
of course,
Your Honor? Yeah. I did not do a deep dive into 611A04, which does describe how at the expiration the restitution order then gets converted to a civil judgment. That is in 611A04. And in 611A04, it cross-references several other statutes, which are then, we're getting into tax world, which I am not of that world, so my apologies to the court. But when that happens, the fight moves on to the civil judgment realm. The fight can continue in criminal court if that fight is brought before the expiration of the term. And it benefits defendants that there is an expiration here. You can't continue to, the district courts don't have authority in perpetuity over all defendants all the time, forever and ever. And I don't think that's what appellant is advocating for as a rule today.
So we will read 611A04.
Yes.
If there are any other statutes that you think are relevant to that,
yes,
to the oral argument that you've made on those issues, you are welcome to submit them in a supplementary letter. It's not an order, not a requirement, but you may do so. And speaking for myself, I think it would be helpful. Could I ask one more question about,
yes,
looking at the restitution order in this case? I guess I'm wondering when. I mean, there's paragraph 5 talks about when payment in full is due, and there's several if-then clauses. Which one applies here?
Your Honor, I don't have that order in front of me at the moment.
Oh, it's on page 2 of the addendum. I don't know if you have your addendum.
Page 2? Oh,
oh,
yes.
It's addendum. Paragraph 5?
Yes.
That was the paragraph we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and I was slow to catch up at that point, and I apologize. But so now I'm focusing on that a little bit more and wondering when exactly appellant's restitution payment was due.
The ultimate question is the entire payment is due per the permit payment schedule that is set by the district court. And in this case, this is sort of boilerplate, nonspecific language, but the ultimate question of when the entire amount is due is by the sentence expiration date. And so I agree with you, paragraph five.
So that, and your support for that is the statute. And then otherwise, you're saying there's a schedule that's probably in the district court record, but not in the addendum? Is that what you're saying?
I am not saying that. What I am saying is when a district court orders restitution, it is not always done with a payment schedule that takes effect and is written and signed by everybody at the date of sentencing, because finances flux, and sometimes in a prison case, the case manager can work with the offender on that. Restitution is not like an easy paint-by-numbers situation that is done at sentencing where paragraph five is perfect and fulfilled and applied, and that is unfortunate. But at the end of the day, the restitution is due at the payment expiration date, and that is why at the sentence expiration date, the amount was then converted to a civil judgment, then pursued immediately by the Department of Revenue. So that's the timeline there.
And that happened in this case?
Yes, it did. Okay. And that's what triggered appellant to bring its motion in criminal court.
Well, and is that in our district court record, or you're telling us things that are otherwise known to you?
It is in a footnote, so I did read it in the record, and I'm not sure if it's in appellant's brief as well, but I don't put things in my brief that weren't part of the record. So if Your Honor would like me to put a note in a supplemental authority letter with a citation to the record, I can do that as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Rasmus, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to make three or four brief comments, depending on how they go, at least three. So the first one, I'd like to respond to the jurisdictional question. And again, Judge Crockett, you brought that up, and Judge Johnson as well. What we argued in our reply brief, and I apologize, you caught me a little flat-footed, Judge Crockett, during my initial argument. I didn't spin out the argument very much on page one of our reply, but what I can elaborate here a little bit more, I think, and say that the cases stand for the proposition that this court has already concluded that if payment is due and owing on a part of a criminal sentence, then the court has jurisdiction. And at this point, there is still a payment due and owing, and that would then support our argument that the court has jurisdiction, that the district court has jurisdiction. We do have supplemental materials in our brief, and in answering your question, Judge Johnson, about the record, we did include information from the Department of Revenue, and I cited statutes from that control, how that judgment works and the collection process. But those cases in the statute, I didn't see any place where there's a statement that the district court is relieved of jurisdiction just because a civil judgment processed through the Department of Revenue takes over. So our argument would be that because payment is still due and owing, that's the underlying basis for the restitution. And we contemplated this. Do we challenge the Minnesota Department of Revenue, or do we challenge the underlying basis for it? Once we learned of this, we thought the best way to do it is to bring the district court motion and be in front of Your Honors as we are right now.
You didn't request a hearing that you could have requested. I mean, this is not determinative of the issue before us, but I don't see any indication that you requested a hearing pursuant to the Department of Revenue process.
We didn't request a hearing, but my client, this is not part of the record, Your Honor, but in response to your question, my client has talk to the department directly. I mean, the reality here too is, he had 45 months and he didn't serve the entire time. He got out on parole, and then his sentence expired after he was done with parole. He's living in a halfway house. He's a convicted felon. He's not going to be able to come up with $250,000. He just doesn't, because the money was gone too. So, I mean, I'm not asking for sympathy, but that's just the reality. There is no basis to pay that judgment at this point, except through a process that he has initiated with the Department of Revenue in the event that this does not work out, the appeal.
Are you aware of any case that addresses Rule 27.03, the language that a district court may at any time correct a sentence not authorized by law and whether that might be applicable in this situation.
I didn't cite any of that case law, Your Honor. If it would be helpful, I, you know, I could go back and look, but I didn't cite any, cite that, that case law. Well, with my remaining time, I'll just address two other quick items. One is that, and I want to reiterate, as we did in the reply brief, about the sophisticated nature of the parties here. I mean, Alina, is, as we know, is well-lawyered. Great American is well-lawyered. When there's a subrogation that occurs and a lawsuit is initiated like this, I mean, Alina is aware that Great American stepped into its shoes and that it was taking all of its claims, including the claim that it wanted to get restitution or get a judgment for the restitution amount. So I think that, you know, again, going back to what the argument was earlier, when the release came forward on the part of Great American, either Great American stepped into a line of shoes or it didn't. You know, there was a subrogation or there wasn't. Either, you know, you have to live with the consequences of subrogation on the part of Alina or you don't. It's conditional or it's not conditional. And I think that's an issue to struggle with in this decision.
Mr. Rasmus, have any other cases involving a subrogation with restitution?
I looked, Your Honor, and I tried, I cited Weber and a couple other cases that I thought were similar, but I couldn't find anything directly on point. The court may do a better job of finding case law that would be direct, but I really struggled and looked hard for that, and I couldn't find anything that I thought was directly on point. One other. Oh, the only last thing I'd like to address is that slippery slope argument, and I think it's, and with all due respect to the county attorney's office, I think it's a little bit mischaracterized. I'm out of time, I guess. So
you may conclude your thought and then wrap up.
Thank you. So this case, if the court would rule in Mr. Johnson's favor, it's not a slippery slope. It's not all victims that would get off the hook if there's an insurance claim filed. It's really a subrogation issue where and it's not often, I don't think, that a subrogee like Great American takes on a case against a victim, a civil case, and then also includes in its complaint the request to go after the restitution as well. I mean, if Great American had not included restitution in its complaint, we wouldn't have an argument. But because it did, we think that Alina has to live with the results of the settlement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmus. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its written opinion within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honors.